Chapter 39. Dana Seagram stood confidently at the lectern and deftly fielded the questions put to her by the 80-odd reporters seated in the NUMA headquarters auditorium. She smiled continuously, with the happy look of a woman who is enjoying herself and who knows she would be approved of. She wore a terracotta color wrapped skirt and a deeply V'd sweater, neatly accented by a small mahogany necklace. She was tall, appealing and elegant, an image that immediately put her inquisitors at a disadvantage. A white-haired woman on the left side of the room rose and waved her hand. "Dr. Seagram?" Dana nodded gracefully. "Dr. Seagram, the readers of my paper, the Chicago Daily, would like to know why the government is spending millions to salvage an old rusty ship. Why wouldn't the money be better spent elsewhere, say for welfare, or badly needed urban renewal?"
"I'll be happy to clear the air for you," Dana said. "To begin with, raising the Titanic is not a waste of money. $290 million have been budgeted, and so far we are well below that figure, and, I might add, ahead of schedule."
"Don't you consider that a lot of money?"
"Not when you consider the possible return. You see, the Titanic is a veritable storehouse of treasure. Estimates run over $300 million. There are many of the passengers' jewels and valuables still on board, $250,000 worth in one stateroom alone. Then there are the ship's fittings, as well as the furnishings and the precious decor, some of which may have survived. A collector would gladly pay anywhere from $500 to $1,000 for one piece of china or a crystal goblet from the first-class dining room. No, ladies and gentlemen, this is one time when a federal project is not, if you'll pardon the expression, a taxpayer ripoff. We will show a profit in dollars, and a profit in historical artifacts of a bygone era, not to mention the tremendous wealth of data for marine science and technology."
"Dr. Seagram," this from a tall, pinched-faced man in the rear of the auditorium, "we haven't had time to read the press release you passed out earlier. So could you please enlighten us as to the mechanics of the salvage?"
"I'm glad you asked me that," Dana laughed. "Seriously, I apologize for the old cliché, but your question, sir, is the cue for a brief slide presentation that should help explain many of the mysteries regarding the project."
She turned to the wings of the stage.
"Lights, please."
The lighting dimmed, and the first slide marched onto a wide screen above and behind the lectern. "We begin with a composite of over 80 photographs pieced together to show the Titanic as she rests on the seafloor. Fortunately, she is sitting upright, with a light less to port, which conveniently puts the 100-yard-long gash she received from the iceberg in an accessible position to seal."
"How is it possible to seal an opening that size at that enormous depth?"
The next slide came on, and showed a man holding what looked like a large blob of liquid plastic.
"In answer to that question," Dana said, "this is Dr. Amos Stanford demonstrating a substance he developed called wet steel. As the name suggests, wet steel, though pliable in air, hardens to the rigidity of steel 90 seconds after coming in contact with water, and it can bond itself to a metal object as though it were welded."
This last statement was followed by a wave of murmurs throughout the room.
"Ball-shaped aluminum tanks, 10 feet in diameter, that contain wet steel, have been dropped at strategic spots around the vessel," Dana continued. "They're designed so that a submersible can attach itself to the tank, not unlike the docking procedure of a shuttle rocket with a space laboratory, and then proceed to the working area, where the crew can aim and expel the wet steel from a specially designed nozzle."
"How is the wet steel pumped from the tank?"
"To illustrate with another comparison, the great pressure at that depth compresses the aluminum tank much like a tube of toothpaste, squeezing the sealant through the nozzle and into the opening to be covered."
She signaled for a new slide.
"Now here we see a cutaway drawing of the sea, depicting the supply tenders on the surface and the submersibles clustered around the wreck on the bottom. there are 4 manned underwater vehicles involved in the salvage operation. The Sappho-1, which you may recall was the craft used on the Lorelei Kura drift expedition, is currently engaged in patching the damage caused by the iceberg along the starboard side of the hull, and also the bows, where they were shattered by the Titanic spoilers. The Sappho-2, a newer and more advanced sister ship, is sealing the smaller openings, such as the air vents and portholes. The Navy's submersible, the Sea Slug, has the job of cutting away unnecessary debris, including the masts, rigging, and the aft funnel which fell across the after boat deck. And finally, the Deep Fathom, a submersible belonging to the Uranus Oil Corporation, is installing pressure relief valves on the Titanic's hull and superstructure.
Could you please explain the purpose of the valves, Dr. Seagram?
Certainly, Dana replied. When the hull begins its journey to the surface, the air that has been pumped into her interior will begin to expand as the pressure of the sea lessens against her exterior. Unless this inside pressure is continuously bled, the Titanic could conceivably blow herself to pieces. The valves, of course, are there to prevent this disastrous occurrence.
Then Numa intends to use compressed air to lift the derelict?
Yes. The support tender Capricorn has 2 compressor units capable of displacing the water in the Titanic's hull with enough air to raise her.
Dr. Seagram, came another disembodied voice. I represent science today, and I happen to know that the water pressure where the Titanic lies is upwards of 6,000 pounds per square inch. I also know that the largest available air compressor can only put out 4,000 pounds. How do you intend to overcome this differential?
The main unit on board the Capricorn pumps the air from the surface through a reinforced pipe to the secondary pump, which is stationed amidships of the wreck. In appearance, this secondary pump looks like a radial aircraft engine with a series of pistons spreading from a central hub. Again, we utilize the sea's great abyssal pressures to activate the pump, which is also assisted by electricity and the air pressure coming from above. I'm sorry, I can't give you an in-depth description, but I am a marine archaeologist, not a marine engineer. However, Admiral Sandecker will be available later in the day to answer your technical questions in greater detail.
What about suction? The voice of science today persisted. After sitting embedded in the silt all these years, won't the Titanic be fairly well glued to the bottom?
She will indeed.
Dana gestured for the lights.
They came on, and she stood blinking in the glare for a few moments until she could distinguish her inquirer. He was a middle-aged man with long brown hair and large wire-rimmed glasses. When it is calculated that the ship has enough air to lift her mast toward the surface, the air pipe will be disconnected from the hull and converted to inject an electrolyte chemical, processed by the Myers-Lentz Company, into the sediment surrounding the Titanic's keel. The resulting reaction will cause the molecules in the sediment to break down and form a cushion of bubbles that will erase the static friction and allow the great bulk to wrest herself free from the suction.
Another man raised his hand. If the operation is successful and the Titanic begins floating toward the surface, isn't there a good chance she could capsize? 2.5 miles is a long way for an unbalanced object of 45,000 tons to remain upright.
You're right. There is the possibility she might capsize. But we plan to leave enough water in her lower holds to act as ballast and offset this problem.
A young, mannish-looking woman rose and waved her hand.
Dr. Seagram, I am Connie Sanchez of Female Eminence Weekly, and my readers would be interested in learning what defense mechanisms you have personally developed for competing on a day-to-day basis in a profession dominated by egotistic male pigheads.
The audience of reporters greeted the question with uneasy silence.
God, Dana thought to herself, it had to come sooner or later. She stepped alongside the lectern and leaned on it in a negligent, almost sexy attitude.
My reply, Ms. Sanchez, is strictly off the record.
Then you're copping out, said Connie Sanchez with a superior grin.
Dana ignored the jab.
First, I find that a defense mechanism is hardly necessary. My masculine colleagues respect my intelligence enough to accept my opinions. I don't have to go braless or spread my legs to get their attention. Second, I prefer standing on my own home ground and competing with members of my own sex. Not a strange stance when you consider the fact that out of 540 scientists on the staff of NUMA, 114 are women. And third, Ms. Sanchez, the only pigheads it's been my misfortune to meet during my life have not been men, but rather the female of the species.
For several moments, a stunned silence gripped the room. Then, suddenly, shattering the embarrassed quiet, a voice burst from the audience.
"Atta girl, Doc!" yelled the little white-haired lady from the Chicago Daily. "That's putting her down."
A sea of applause rippled and then roared, sweeping the auditorium in a storm of approval. The battle-hardened Washington correspondents offered her their respect with a standing ovation. Connie Sanchez sat in her seat and stared coldly in flushed anger. Dana saw Connie's lips form the word "bitch," and she returned a smug, derisive kind of smile that only women do so well. Adulation, Dana thought. How sweet it is.